Coming up on StarStuff, the Southern Hemisphere's only program searching for Earth-threatening asteroids and comets could be forced to shut down because of a lack of funding. The sun unleashes a series of four powerful solar flares as Solar Max lives up to its name. And has the planet-hunting Kepler Space Telescope, which has changed our view of the cosmos, been dealt a fatal blow? All that and more coming up on StarStuff.
This is StarStuff.
The Siding Spring Telescope, threatened with closure, has discovered its 100th comet. The finding makes the Uppsala Telescope at the Siding Spring Observatory in rural New South Wales the third most successful ground-based comet-discovering observatory in history. The new visitor, designated C2013J2, is a long-period comet. That means its orbit will take at least 200 years to complete, and possibly a lot longer, that's if the comet originates from the Oort cloud. The new discovery adds to a long list of famous comets found as part of the Siding Spring survey, including McNaught, Garrard, Christensen, Lemon, and Comet Siding Spring. Throughout history, comets have been seen as portents of doom, and these celebrations may be short-lived because after surviving the bushfires which ravaged Coonabarabran in January, the telescope is facing closure because of a lack of funding for the Siding Spring survey. Astronomer Dr. Rob McNaught says the telescope's the only facility in the Southern Hemisphere searching for comets, asteroids and meteors which pose a threat to Earth. According to McNaught, the Siding Spring survey is designed to look for near-Earth objects. Near-Earth objects are any asteroid, meteor or comet on an orbit passing close to or threatening the Earth.
The focus is near-Earth objects, which is any object, regardless of whether it's a comet or asteroid, which can pass close to the Earth. Essentially, we're trying to inventory the solar system to find all moving objects that potentially could be a threat to the Earth. If they happen to be comets, it doesn't make any difference in terms of the impact threat. I mean, an asteroid that's has an orbital period of a few years, when you talk about millennia to millions of years, it's clear to see that the Earth is being hit by these objects. There's a vast amount of evidence from the Moon's surface and the Earth's surface, and extrapolating up from small objects which are seen to hit the Earth's, every day, essentially. Objects like Tunguska and, I'll get the pronunciation wrong here, maybe you can see it.
The object that hit Chelyabinsk.
Ah, that's the one, yes.
As a radio announcer, I've learned to practice that.
Very good.
Don't ask me to recite the names of any Icelandic volcanoes, however.
Objects like Tunguska and the one you just mentioned certainly indicate that the Earth is a target for very energetic events, not sizable objects. I mean, you're only talking about the recent object, only, 15 metres or so across, and Tunguska around 40 to 50 metres. So small objects travelling at very high speeds, and you're talking about several to tens of kilometres a second, they pack a massive amount of energy, and they don't have to hit the ground. It can just be the
airburst.
The airbursts as they're coming through the atmosphere that can do the damage.
Is there a big effort on to search for these asteroids and comets and meteors which do pose a threat to the Earth?
Well, currently the Uppsala telescope at Siding Spring is the only systematic survey in the south. It's a relatively small telescope. It's only half a metre aperture. So that limits how faint we can see. However, the objects we are seeing tend to be bright. Bright objects tend to be big. So the average size of the objects being discovered from the Uppsala telescope do tend to be rather larger than the ones being discovered by the other survey telescopes, which are discovering up to 10 times as many objects. But the bulk of those are very much smaller objects. The other thing that makes an object bright is they're closer to the Earth. So we are finding in the relatively small number of objects we're finding, there's a much higher proportion of large objects and close objects. So the percentage of objects we are finding contributing to the potentially hazardous asteroids, which are objects larger than roughly around 100 metres and passing very close to the Earth, we're finding around 10% or so of the world discovery of from all the telescopes of these potentially hazardous asteroids. And with the 1 kilometre plus size, they're only a small number being found each year. They've gone down in the last few years from around 20 to a little bit over 10, but they're still being found. We're not quite at completion yet.
You need one to get through, don't you?
Oh, indeed.
Who funds Uppsala?
Well, currently we're getting NASA funds again up until the end of July, but beyond July there's no funding available, so it's still questionable as to whether or not the program will continue beyond July.
So what happens after July? The operations need to continue. It's the only one in the Southern Hemisphere. If there's no funding, what happens?
I guess I become unemployed and the telescope shuts down. I mean, that's essentially what the future would be if no money's available.
Your job should be to look for the dangers up there, not fundraise, but I guess you've had to be doing some fundraising.
I have done some. It's not been successful, unfortunately, no.
Have you talked to the federal government? I mean...
Well, the federal government and, there's a local large miner opening up operations around Coonabarabran. I approached them as well, but neither of those have succeeded.
Couldn't find any money to help fund this telescope?
No, unfortunately, I got a long list of departments not willing to fund it.
What about the opposition?
No, it's not really been discussed, and it sounds like that might be the... possible source of funding in the future, though it is sad. It's sad from the point of view. It's a fully operational telescope. It's doing its job. It's doing its job for relatively low cost. And from the personal point of view, I absolutely love the work I do. But that shouldn't really have any bearing on the project as a scientific enterprise. I think it should stand on its own merit.
What are the annual operating costs of the telescope, and everything from the power bill through to whatever?
Right, it's around $110,000 a year.
It's not much.
That's the current cost.
That's Dr. Robert McNaught from the Siding Springs Survey. So far, McNaught's credited with the discovery of some 467 asteroids and 81 comets. Dr. Simon O'Toole from the Australian Astronomical Observatory says McNaught's work is unique in the Southern Hemisphere.
That would be a bit of a tragedy. Particularly because this is, the third most successful comet survey that we've ever done, and it's based in the southern sky, so it's especially... important for us here in Australia. And I think a lot of the other ones have been much more automated. This is still relies on a bit of power, a bit of someone sitting there in the telescope taking images and then going through and looking at the images for the comets as they move across the sky. So, it does take a little bit, quite a lot of time and effort to do this. But it's very efficient, obviously, because if they're finding 100, that's more than most, particularly, say, with, the Russian meteorite earlier in the year and some of the beautiful comets that have been discovered there. Comet McNaught a few years ago, I think that was 2007, was especially spectacular. Hopefully some money can be found to keep this program going.
Mount Stromlo Observatory astronomer Dr. Brad Tucker says the Australian National University has been actively trying to encourage NASA to keep funding the survey.
Yes, unfortunately, with the current funding situation in the U.S., and especially sequestration, one of the programs that has been cut has been Rob's survey. And we at ANU have been actively trying to encourage NASA to refund at least get a temporary stay until we can find a permanent solution to Rob's search. Right towards the end of mid-2012, NASA decided to cut off the funding, and ANU has found money to keep them going, but we're running it even out of that money now. And, our main point we're trying to make is right now we're actually blind in the south to these objects. Without Rob's survey, there's nothing really as efficient and productive as Rob's survey.
I understand NASA's problem is they're not allowed to fund foreign research. It's got to be funded through a third body, which is where University of Arizona come in.
That's correct. So the telescope and the facilities and employment, Rob's kind of a far employee of University of Arizona because all NASA money must go through a U.S. institution. That's correct. But NASA's trickled, essentially turning off the faucet, so that money's slowing University of Arizona, and their first priority is their main projects and people.
And that's Catalina and Mount Lemmon.
Exactly. Yeah. Therefore, Rob is he's at the end of the pipeline and there's no water coming out.
What happens at the end of July? The funding gets cut off?
At end of July, if nothing is found, all the equipment must be packed up and shipped back to Arizona. And if that happens, then essentially nothing can come back from that. Once things are packed up, it's not going to come back here. And Rob will have to do something else. So one of the most successful comet and near-Earth object discoverers in human history will have to find another job. And if something like the meteor that hit over northern Russia in February happens, we won't see this coming.
Tucker warns if something like the meteor which airburst over the Siberian city of Chelyabinsk in northern Russia happens over Sydney, people won't be too happy. The February 15th Chelyabinsk meteor was only about 17 metres wide, but it generated a shockwave which smashed windows and damaged buildings, injuring over 1,500 people. A spokesperson for the Shadow Science Minister, Sophie Mirabella, says $100,000 for something like this seems like back-of-the-couch money for a government which is spending on pre-election advertising. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for Science Minister Senator Don Farrell says the routine surveillance of near-Earth objects has not been identified as a research priority by the Australian astronomy research community. The sun has unleashed four powerful solar flares, making the most intense period of solar activity so far this year. The flares, which originate from the same area of the sun, are occurring as the sun is at solar maximum, the climax of its 11-year solar cycle. One of the flares was classified as an X3.2 flare, the X-class being the most intense type of solar flare. In fact, NASA scientists have described it as the strongest X-class flare of 2013 so far, surpassing the strength of two previous X-class flares that occurred earlier on the same day. A fourth X-class flare, also in the same group, erupted a day later. Measuring X1.2, it caused a temporary radio blackout that has since subsided and was categorized as strong, or R3, on a scale of 1 to 5 on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Scale. All of the flares set off bursts of intense radiation and particles from the sun known as coronal mass ejections, the strongest traveling at some 2,253 kilometers per second. According to NASA, these coronal mass ejections could produce a merged cloud of solar material that may give a glow to the Stereo B satellite as well as the Epoxy spacecraft, both of which are space-based observatories orbiting Earth and monitoring solar storms and comets. Mission managers for both spacecraft have been notified and, if warranted, they'll put their spacecraft into safe modes in order to protect delicate instruments. According to space weather experts at NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, America's Weather Bureau, more strong solar flares may be expected in coming days. Although coronal mass ejections do send off lots of potent radiation from the sun, the Earth's protected from this by its magnetic field. However, this solar activity can disrupt satellites, GPS signals, and high-frequency communications, as well as power grids. Back in 1989, Quebec and much of southeastern Canada were blacked out by just such an event. But these solar storms also mean spectacular auroral light shows at higher latitudes. The first X-class flare of this solar cycle occurred back in February 2011. The largest so far in the current cycle was documented as an X6.9. That was back in August of 2011. Scientists tell me that overall this solar max has been a fairly mild affair compared to previous events. Astronomers have discovered a family of comets that have risen from the dead thanks to a change in their orbits. The study on the pre-press physics blog archive.org and accepted for publication in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society has examined a group of objects in the main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter with asteroidal orbits and comet-like behaviour. Researchers from the University of Antioquia in Medellin, Colombia, found numerous objects which they call asteroid belt comets, or ABCs, we sort of like that title, which were dormant but rejuvenated when their orbits changed. The authors say the asteroid belt contains an enormous graveyard of ancient, dormant and extinct rocky comets. They believe these can be turned on or rejuvenated if their orbits are suddenly changed, moving them closer to the Sun. Comets, which no longer emit volatile gases and are consequently not active, are usually just called asteroids. Previous research has shown collisions with asteroids, meteors, or even other comets can rejuvenate a dormant comet, bringing it back to life. Solar wind sputtering, in which high-energy particles from the Sun strike a comet, can also bring dormant comets back to life. Other proposals which scientists think may result in the reactivation of a comet are things like electrostatic levitation or even rotational bursting. What these scientists did was examine how planetary gravitational perturbations and resonances can move comets into new orbits, bringing them closer to the Sun. They say the orbital change simply allows more heat from the Sun to penetrate further, deeper into the comet. That causes the sublimation of additional water ices and other volatiles which may be locked down deeper inside the comet's nucleus. The authors calculated the temperature of each comet compared to its distance from the Sun. They then developed a mathematical model to work out the thickness of the crust encasing each comet based on the time it took for the comet to begin sublimating after its orbit changed. See, comets can develop a thick crust of carbon-rich compounds and dust left behind as the comet's ices evaporate. What they found was a thickness of 2 metres plus or minus half a metre for the comet 107P, a thickness of 4.7 metres plus or minus 1.2 metres for the comet 133P, and a thickness of 1.9 metres plus or minus half a metre for a sample of 9 other comets. Researchers made a specific point of the small error margins. For comparison, they pointed to deep impact images of the nucleus of the comet Tempel 1, which revealed several layers between 1 and 20 metres thick that parallel the surface. And for the asteroid Gaspra, they showed evidence suggests that it was covered with regolith a few tens to several tens of metres thick, both showing far greater error margins than those calculated for these 11 comets. By understanding how much crust there is covering the comet's ice, the researchers were able to model the behaviour and release of that ice as the comet's orbit moves closer to the Sun. Their study also identified 4 comets which are now in the process of being rejuvenated. This research has energised fresh debate on the issue, according to astronomer Dr. Brad Carter from the University of Southern Queensland. He says we're seeing further evidence of the blurred division between what constitutes an asteroid and how that's different to what makes up a comet.
It looks like these guys have found what they call Lazarus comets or asteroid belt comets. And these are objects that are in the main belt of the asteroid belt, but behaving like comets in the sense that they showing the volatiles, the ice is becoming gases, so just like a comet gives off gases, these things do too. And I guess what these guys are saying quite specifically is I think what's happening here is there are objects they call comets in the asteroid belt that are rejuvenated, brought back to life by planetary perturbations, making these objects go ever closer to the Sun in their closest distance in their orbit. So they're orbiting in the main belt of the asteroid belt, but they're a planet like Jupiter or some other planet will perturb their orbit and it will make the near point of their orbit to the Sun ever closer, and that's enough to cook these things and to liberate ices from them. And so what they're saying is they're sort of this process has produced a rejuvenation of these objects as comets.
And is it just perturbations from planets, or can it also be collisions amongst themselves moving them into changing their perihelion?
Absolutely, a good point. That's another process that they talk about in the paper that could be a mechanism for this rejuvenation. So you have a collision that will liberate these ices and the gases. You'll get something that looks like a puff of material from these things, just like you would from a comet.
comets, when they're doing their cometary thing, they can build up quite a thick crust, can't they, of just dust and burnt material on their surface. They get close to the sun. The material on their surface is hit by particles from the sun. That changes their composition. It can turn them into a pretty hard crust. So sometimes if that crust is thick enough, the comet stops being a comet. So it doesn't need much to just turn it into a comet again.
That's exactly right. So as you say, that when you think of a comet, you might think of something that actually has a dusty crust on top of it, a dark crust, something that's holding in the ices. And you actually need to break open that crust before you liberate the ices. But if you have enough of heating of the object, then you will get that crust giving way to produce a release of the ices as volatiles, as gases.
Any comet that doesn't release volatiles is simply an asteroid.
That's exactly right. That's what I'd call an asteroid. And in fact, one thing I noticed about this paper is that the authors refer to these objects as asteroidal belt comets or Lazarus comets. Mm. But I think an entirely valid alternate name for them would be, in fact, to call them active asteroids. David Jewett at the University of California, Los Angeles, talks about active asteroids to describe objects that are fundamentally asteroids in terms of their orbits and their materials. It certainly has a lot of dust and rock in it, but there is, in addition, a lot of ice. And so what some person might call a comet in an asteroid belt, another person might call it, there's an active asteroid that has comet-like behavior in releasing its ices as a gas or a dust tail.
Does this blur the line between comets and asteroids even further? Because the line's already blurred, let's face it.
That's right, Stuart. I think you've made a very good point. What we're seeing here is further evidence for the fact that there is really a great blurred division between asteroids and comets, in that these objects contain a mixture of ices and more rocky material. At some point, you arbitrarily change the name of the object from asteroid to comet, depending on what the orbit might look like, and also what the material of the object is like. In other words, how much ice is there compared to how much rock and dust and rocky material.
That's astronomer Dr. Brad Carter from the University of Southern Queensland. Well, it's bad news for NASA's famous planet-hunting Kepler Space Telescope. It has suffered a critical failure in its positioning system, a failure so severe it could threaten the entire mission. The problem involves a gyroscope-like reaction wheel, one of three needed to keep the telescope steady enough to allow its photodetector array to monitor over 100,000 stars simultaneously. You see, in order to detect exoplanets orbiting their host stars, the spacecraft needs to remain really steady, incredibly still, so that those stars don't wind up wandering across the optics. And in order to remain so still, the spacecraft's equipped with four reaction wheels, sort of like very advanced gyroscopes, gyrodynes. Three are needed to work all the time, and the fourth is a spare. But one of those wheels failed a year ago and was shut off. Because at least three wheels must be kept operating to keep Kepler stable, the failure of this second wheel has forced the shutdown of Kepler's operations. Launched back in 2009, the $650 million Kepler Space Telescope revolutionized science's study of exoplanets. It's helped bring the tally of exoplanets orbiting distant stars up to over 850, with over 2,700 potential planets or planetary candidates still awaiting confirmation. As we mentioned before, the telescope's designed to gaze steadfastly at 100,000 distant sun-like stars. It's searching for planets passing or transiting in front of those stars relative to its line of sight. As the planet passes in front of the star, there's a slight dimming in light coming from that star, like an eclipse. And detecting the slight dips in the amount of light from a crossing planet in the face of a host star requires extremely precise pointing. Kepler was specifically targeting Earth-sized planets orbiting in the habitable zone of their host stars, where temperatures would allow liquid water to exist on the planet's surface. The mission was originally designed to last 4 years, and now it seems to achieve that mission goal of lasting 4 years. Remember, it was launched in 2009. In the process, it's provided astronomers with many more years of archived observations yet to analyze. So even if it is shut down, Kepler's discoveries will keep on coming. Because the telescope's orbiting a distance of 64 million kilometres from the Earth, it's too far for a robotic or astronaut-led repair mission. In addition to obviously trying to get the failed wheel working, engineers and scientists are looking at alternative ways to operate the telescope. Now, there may be two possible ways for mission managers to salvage the spacecraft. The first involves trying to reactivate the reaction wheel they turned off a year ago. See, it was turned off because of a lubrication issue. The oil wasn't getting to where it was needed, so we're having a situation of metal on metal, resulting in friction interfering with its operations. But that was a year ago. The remaining lubricant in the wheel has now had a year to redistribute itself in the microgravity of space. And so, theoretically, it could possibly work again if activated. The second option would involve using a combination of the spacecraft's thrusters and solar pressure exerted on the solar panels by the sun to try and act as a third reaction wheel and provide additional stability. Both are long shots, and in the meantime, mission managers are also assessing whether or not Kepler could be used for other observations which don't require such precise pointing. The first Canadian astronaut to command the International Space Station has safely touched down in Kazakhstan with two crewmates, wrapping up a five-month mission aboard the International Space Station.
Once it's on the ground, search and recovery forces will begin to save the vehicle and prepare to extract the crew. What exactly they'll be doing will depend on the vehicle orientation once it touches down, whether it lands upright or ends up on its side, both of which are planned for and considered nominal landings.
The Expedition 35 Soyuz capsule touched down under an orange parachute, raising clouds of dust as it ignited an engine to cushion its landing on the central Kazakh steppe. Mission Control outside Moscow reported the crew was safe and well following their fiery descent from orbit. The three astronauts were shown smiling and seated in semi-reclined chairs covered with blue thermal blankets, waiting for medical tests after their landing. About 3.5 hours earlier, the space station's commander, Chris Hadfield, and fellow crewmates departed the $100 billion orbital outpost as it sailed 410 kilometres over eastern Mongolia, leaving the first three Expedition 36 crew members on board. Hadfield and his colleagues had blasted off from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan 146 days earlier. The safe landing caps off what's been an interesting week aboard the space station. Astronauts had to undertake a hastily planned spacewalk last week to repair an ammonia leak. The culprit was a suspected faulty coolant pump located at the far end of one of the external trusses of the orbiting outpost. Two NASA astronauts donned their spacesuits and exited the station's airlock for a 5.5-hour EVA, or extravehicular activity, to attempt to stem the ammonia coolant leak. Astronauts installed a spare pump, then positioned themselves to check for signs of escaping ammonia ice crystals when the system was turned back on. Mission managers think a meteorite or a piece of orbital debris hit the cooling radiator, causing the problem in the first place. Engineers believe the leak was most likely coming from in or around the 118-kilogram pump which pushes ammonia through the system. The ammonia is used as a coolant to dissipate heat from electronics in the space station's solar-powered electrical system. The station can be reconfigured to compensate for a system shutdown, but if a second problem were to develop, that would have meant a cutback in power available for experiments. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.